Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihuliwan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning. My guest this morning is Dublin writer Catherine Dunn. Her latest novel is called The Things We Know Now, and that book has just won the prestigious Giovanni Boccaccio International Prize for Fiction in Italy. Catherine worked as a teacher before becoming a full-time writer, and The Things We Know Now is her 10th book. So Catherine, congratulations on
this
recent
award.
Were you surprised when you heard the news?
Absolutely. It came completely out of the blue. I was in Italy at a festival and just doing the thing that a writer normally does at festivals, which is meeting readers and reading and generally enjoying beautiful weather and glorious scenery. And my publisher happened to come to that particular festival and told me very quietly that if I would accept the award, and I sort of thought, why would one not accept the award? So I did. And then I had to keep it quiet for quite some time before it was announced publicly. So, yeah, it was great. Every writer obviously writes something for people to read and enjoy and find some kind of connection with. You don't write books to be put in a drawer.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that people had found something, some sort of resonance, and that they liked the writing and enjoyed the story of the characters, that was, it was wonderful. I mean, had there been nothing other than just the name to go with it, it would have been fantastic. But there was a very nice prize and a leather-bound edition of the
beautiful
book, which was a lovely touch, yeah.
And what part of Italy was this?
In Tuscany. It's an extraordinary place, actually. I mean, it's where Boccaccio was born, Petrarch, Dante.
So these are all the Renaissance writers.
All the Renaissance writers. And Machiavelli was also born there as well, but we won't talk about him. It's just a huge, as they call it, a cultural cradle. So it was a great privilege. The town was called Certaldo Alto, and it's way up on a hill. I mean, you can walk around it and still imagine what life was like in the 1400s. Now, it's cleaner now, I would imagine, than it was back in the 1400s. But the very narrow medieval streets, and it's completely unchanged. The one shock I got actually was seeing an ATM in one of the walls. But other than that, it is a medieval village.
And Catherine, does it surprise you that your books are so successful then in Italy?
It has always been a surprise. I mean, my first book was published there shortly after it was published here. So that would have been around 1999, I think, in Italy, the late 90s anyway. And the first book took off.
And Mrs. Berlusconi played a small part in some of your success.
Oh, well, this was extraordinary. I was actually living in Spain at the time and I was finishing a novel. And I got a text message early one morning from a friend who lives in Rome to say, "You're all over the newspapers." So I rang her and I said, "I'm not even there. What am I supposed to have done?" So she told me that Veronica Lario, who was then married to Silvio Berlusconi, had finally got fed up of his philandering. And he had propositioned a young woman very publicly at a TV awards the previous night. And this was in full view of the media. And Italy would be divided very much down the middle, those who love Berlusconi and those who hate him. So those who hate him thought, right, this is fair game. He has done this in public. We're not brushing it under the carpet. You know, we're going to make something of this. So they did. And they rebroadcast his proposition to the young woman and they took photographs. And his wife, naturally, understandably, was very humiliated by this. So she demanded a public apology and she didn't get one. So she thought, right. And she went to his arch rival, La Repubblica, which would be the more left-wing newspaper. And she crafted a letter. And there were many things in the letter. It was actually a wonderful letter. It was very dignified. And she said that this was no example to give their children. She'd had 4 or 5 children with them. And it certainly was no example to give young men as to how women should be treated.
Oh.
And that she certainly could not sit down under this treatment because she would, by definition, be endorsing it. So she demanded that he apologise publicly. And at the end of it, she said that the first book that's published there of mine in Italian is called Half of Nothing. And it's looking at a marriage breakdown, at a woman who feels half of nothing when her husband abandons her. And she says that you made me feel like a character in Catherine Dunn's novel. You made me feel like half of nothing. So this, of course, exploded. And anybody who hadn't heard of the book at that stage certainly heard of it by the end of the day. So I had great fun watching the body language where Mr. Berlusconi eventually did make his very half-hearted public apology.
You think it was a half-hearted apology?
Oh, yeah. You could just, all you need to do is look at pictures of him. But I think I knew even then this was the first shot being fired in a very expensive divorce campaign, and so it was proved.
And how did you feel then being involved in that very public marital breakdown?
Well, first, my first feeling was that this was surreal. Some over-excited Italian journalist rang me and said, how do you feel about being a footnote in Italian history? And I just burst out laughing. So it was extraordinary. It didn't feel real because I wasn't there. So it didn't have the kind of impact perhaps that it might have done had I lived in Italy. So I watched it with, I suppose, a kind of astonishment from afar.
And you're really riding the crest of a wave at the moment, Catherine, because, you know, you have this fantastic award for your latest novel. You got married last year. Your son is getting married. Is this then a good time in your life? You know, is turning 60 a good time in your life?
I think it's a really good time. Yeah. I think there's a huge level of contentment for me that has come with this age. I don't at all subscribe to the view that as you get older, you've got to give up your interests or you've got to stop being active or you've suddenly got to tone down the things you do. I don't believe that at all. I believe it's a time when, if you're lucky, as I feel I am, where, you know, your children are maturing, off making their own lives, being independent, your own relationship, again, if you're lucky, has settled into a nice pattern. There might be a little bit of wisdom gained along the way. And you've got all of this time when, even if you're still in full-time employment, I mean, I think even if I were still working as a teacher, there's still all of this time that would be outside of that to do the reading and to follow the interests and the theatre and the cinema and the books and all the things that my feeling is always, I don't have enough time to do all the things I want to do.
And you still feel that way?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can honestly say that there isn't even a moment when I could describe myself as bored.
And I think that's a very positive thing to be able to say at any time in your life.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, well, for me, and obviously this is my prejudice, but I think people who read and who are interested in the life of the imagination and all of the world that opens up, I don't think it's possible to be bored. Mm. I think it's possible to be discontented and unhappy, but I don't think it's possible to be bored.
In your novel, Missing Julia, you're charting the relationship of a more mature couple. And not to go into the story because I don't want to give it away for anyone that hasn't read it yet, but is love at that later stage in life, is that different?
I think it is different. It's very difficult to define how it is different, but I think probably the greatest element for me was the element of surprise. Because when my primary relationship ended, I felt that's the end of that part of my life. I will never have anything like that again. I was in my early 50s and I was resigned to that. I had accepted it. Mm. And this was something which blossomed out of friendship. So it was completely unexpected, took me completely by surprise. So that, I think, for me, is probably the difference. It's not something that I was waiting for or looking for. It simply evolved. And with that, with the comfort of friendship, I think that is probably what makes it different from the much younger, headier, more romantic love. And also, I think, with an older relationship where clearly there's no chance of children, that's a different dynamic again, because so much of young people's lives is, when they have children, is naturally and correctly is devoted towards the lives of their children. Mm-hmm. And this is the stage of your life when you can sit back perhaps and be a little bit more reflective and pay a little bit more attention to your own needs. I was really interested recently actually to read that 1 in 5 American women, according to a recent survey, have chosen never to have children for reasons that we in this country might perhaps culturally describe as selfish. I don't. I think it is a positive life option. It's a positive choice. And their reasons for doing so are exactly the reasons I'm talking about here. Mm. That, you know, they have time to focus on the relationships that they've chosen, on their careers. They want freedom. They want to use their money in the way they want to. They want to be economically independent. So it's not simple.
So that's really what makes a difference, maybe getting married for that second time round, because you know that you will have time for one another in the relationship.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there is less, I think there's probably less pressure.
That's interesting. Catherine, tell me about your first piece of music, because it's She's Leaving Home from the Beatles. And interestingly, I've been singing it in my head for the past 3 weeks. And then I took up your book at a time like this. And it's the first song that's mentioned in the book by Claire, who's moving off to go to college for the first time. Why is it a song that resonates with you so much?
Well, I think that whole album is one that resonates with me. And it's something which I listen to it still. And I think it's one of those works of art that become better the more I listen to them. And I think that particular one, I remember even the first time I heard it, that particular song, I thought, what a wonderful story. Mm-hmm. And what I loved so much about that was you see the point of view of the parents, you see the point of view of the girl, you see her hopes, you know it's going to end badly. I mean, even as a teenager, I knew this was going to end badly. And there's also all the resonance of class in there. You know, the man is a man from the motor trade. And I just think the Beatles managed to get so much into those lyrics. They actually, they open up like a tablecloth. They just open up the entire history of two generations of people who happen to live in the one house but don't know each other at all.
And she's leaving home because she was so lonely, and fun is something that money can't buy. I think I love that line from it, because even though her parents were really rich, they actually couldn't give her everything.
Absolutely. And she sees that this is something that she doesn't want. And also it's a grieving process, because she is leaving her home, and she's leaving it silently and secretly. So that's a relationship which one day will either have to be mended or not, but it will always have an impact on the way she lives for the rest of her days.
Do you think that, you know, it's Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is that album. Do you think that as you get older, you listen to those songs differently? Because, you know, it is a different album to the other the Beatles albums.
It is. I mean, you know, I loved all of the other ones, but they were poppy. You know, they were what I wanted to listen to and sing along to when I was a very young teenager. But this, when I heard this was different. This was a quantum leap. This is a reflective album. And as a result, I think, you know, we all bring ourselves to every work of art that we engage with, whether it's a book or whether it's a painting, whether it's a piece of music. So you bring a different self to these songs in particular for me. And because of that, because I'm different listening to them, the genius of the songs is that they still have something to say, no matter how different I am now from what I was 40 years ago.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more, she goes downstairs to the kitchen.
That's the Beatles, and She's Leaving Home from the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album. Catherine, what were you yourself like as a teenager?
Oh dear, I think I can remember probably around the age of 14 when I felt this kind of dark cloud settle around me. And it lasted certainly until I was coming out of 16. I remember 17, the sun began to shine again. It's not that I don't think I was depressed. I was just excruciatingly self-conscious. And I seemed to be overly sensitive to atmosphere and to feeling an outsider and to feeling not part of the things that were going on around me. And my mother used to give out to me about this, you know, and say, you take things too much to heart, which I probably did. But what could I do about it? That's what I was at that particular stage of my life, and I wasn't able to handle it.
Why did you think that developed? Is it just part of being a teenager and going through that? You know, it's a very hard time when you're a girl of 14, or was it something more that you were nervous about?
I think being a teenager is excruciating, full stop. And I don't think that today that it's any different from what it was when I was a teenager. The challenges might be slightly different, but I think the feelings, that insecurity, the self-consciousness, the embarrassment that goes with everything. I've just finished reading David Park, actually, The Light of Amsterdam, and there's just a magnificent section in it where one of the characters goes to Amsterdam with his 16-year-old son. And I thought, I'm there. I can identify with that. And interestingly,
you can identify with the son?
With
the,
both. That was the interesting thing, with both with being a parent and with being a child or a young person of that age. Mm-hmm. I think the world is a very frightening place when you're a teenager. And I felt, although I loved studying, school was always, study was always a refuge. Okay. I didn't have any difficulty going to school at all. But I felt I wasn't in the right place. And I remember, I think I was coming up to Intercert, as it was in those days. And I knew even then that I was interested in writing.
So even though you were anxious maybe with the world around you, you still knew what you wanted to do. You still knew that you wanted to write. How was that so definite in you?
I actually didn't realise until coming close to the end of primary school that reading and writing were different activities. I actually thought they were the same, that one was just one side of the coin. That if you read books and you loved the stories that you read, well, then of course you wrote your own. I was probably around 11 when I figured out, actually, this isn't what everybody does.
And had you been writing stories yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, stories and actually some really bad poetry as well, which I discovered when I was shifting some of the boxes in order to move house. So I'd always been writing. I never wrote with any view in mind other than writing itself. I wrote because I loved it and I entered school competitions and things like that. But I never wrote with any view to publication or that this was ever going anywhere. I just wanted to write.
Yeah. And was there anyone to mentor you, or you were just creative in your own sense?
It was a completely hidden activity. And I suppose there was that bit of me that wanted to keep it that way. If you look back to the time that this was happening in, which was the 1970s, that kind of aspiration simply wasn't even on the radar for a young woman. Or that was my feeling, that it wasn't on the
Why,
radar.
Why,
I left school in 1972, and I think maybe there was six people out of a class of 120, 130 that went on to university. And that for me was where something like being a writer would begin, that you'd have to know what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the expectations for girls in the 1970s were very different from the expectations that there are now. The opportunities and the possibilities were socially and culturally much more limited.
Well, that was nice then, that you were able to kind of hold your writing as your own. Did that wane then when you did go to university?
Yes, it did, which is one of those lovely ironies. I loved university. I loved the reading. I loved the criticism. I loved the discipline and writing the essays. I really enjoyed. But God, did it stunt my creativity. I found at the end of the day, I had just had enough of deconstructing things, and I found it very difficult to go to create something. It was a huge learning curve, but it certainly had a big effect when I began seriously writing myself. Yeah,
Catherine, an event happened in 1991 that affected you as a person and you as a writer as well. Can you tell me what happened that year?
I was pregnant with my second child and a little boy called Owen, who very sadly was stillborn. And that was a huge trauma. It was a trauma on all levels. It was a trauma physically. It was a trauma psychologically, emotionally. It was a trauma in every way. And I regard it, I suppose, as one of the watershed moments of my life, after which nothing was ever the same again. Mm-hmm. It was an enormous loss.
What age were you at this stage, if you don't mind me asking?
I would have been in my very late 30s, maybe 38, 37, 38.
And obviously, you know, it's incredibly traumatic because you first of all lost your baby Owen, and you were also close to death yourself from that. Firstly, tell me about, you know, losing your baby and realising that that was happening and that was going to happen.
It was a very brutal event. It's called an abruption, and it's actually a very good name because it is incredibly abrupt and very, very brutal. It's where the placenta literally falls away from the wall of the uterus and the baby's oxygen is cut off. So that's one comfort, that he did die very gently. It was like going to sleep. So it might have been brutal for me, but it wasn't brutal for him. And that was, even then, that was a certain comfort.
How far gone were you in the pregnancy?
He was due in the next 4 or 5 weeks.
Oh,
so he was pretty much full term. And the hospital were incredibly kind. I mean, I couldn't have asked for better care. But it was physically, it meant that I hemorrhaged massively. and I used up the entire hospital blood supply on that evening. And I remember I was a very early, actually, on a Thursday morning when Owen was born, and my wonderful obstetrician stayed with us for the entire event. And I remember kind of coming to and seeing her with bags of blood under her arm. And I said, Patricia, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to defrost the blood. We can't defrost it quickly enough. You need more. And I remember saying to her, why don't you put it in the microwave? She said, no, we can't, because that would destroy the antibodies. So we had all of these extraordinary conversations.
And did you realise that your life was in danger?
I did. I did, because when I was in the ambulance, I actually knew I was dying. It was a very, very clear thought. And it was one of those moments where I was actually up on the roof of the ambulance looking down on myself.
And what kept you going?
I came to at one point in and out of consciousness, where I remember one thought was, well, if this is dying, it isn't so bad. And then, like a bolt from the blue after that, hang on a second, you've got an 8-year-old, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. And I remember the physical act of pulling myself into consciousness and trying to keep awake until we got to the hospital. And I think I knew even at that stage that it was dangerous, but I knew once I got there, there was a great deal of fumbling trying to get a line in, because all of my veins had collapsed.
Oh, gosh.
So I knew there was a great flurry, there was a huge level of activity. And I could hear, even though I was in and out of consciousness, which the people should remember, we can hear the conversations mm-hmm. that are going on around us. Mm-hmm. So I knew what was happening.
And when you recovered and you went home from the hospital, how were you able to deal with the loss of the baby? You know, were your friends and family, were they that support for you? Because I think it must be very different losing a child that you're expecting. You know, he hasn't had that experience of life even
yes.
yet.
It's a hugely difficult area, I think, for everybody to deal with. If you take your close family, they're also grieving. And I've often felt that the grief response is, the strength of it, is actually an indication of just how close all of those bonds are. So, you know, the baby had a father, mm-hmm. he had a brother, he had grandparents. So there was a huge, everybody was grieving. And everybody does it in different ways. I found two responses, I think. My friends were fantastic for the most part. When I was doing some research on this recently for an essay in a book that was published just last year, I came across a phrase in Urdu where the whole concept of grieving as an individual doesn't exist. That the community becomes what this poetic line calls them as grief eaters. And that's the job of the community. The job of the community is to fold itself around the grieving person and to eat their grief. It's a beautiful line in I don't speak Urdu, but it even looks beautiful on the page. And that, I think, it was the job that my friends took on.
And did they take that on well?
They did. They certainly did.
And how about your son's father as well? Do you think that parents grieve differently? Is the mother and father perspective, is that different?
It is different. And that's not to say that one is better or more genuine or anything else than the other. They're just different. I think one of the things which is different with the mother's experience is that there has been a visceral biological tie to another human being. And when that human being is lost, there is a biological response also. Every cell in your body grieves. I was watching a nature program recently with David Attenborough, where they showed a mother elephant in the drought in Africa who had just lost her baby. And I remember being struck by the expression in the animal's eyes and the way she walked away from that baby. And I thought, it's not just a human response. Mm-hmm. This is a response to all of us who have biological ties to other people. And that's why I think there is a different dimension to it, because it is so visceral. And with that visceral bond for me came a huge rage.
What were you angry at?
I was angry at anybody that I felt might be responsible. And the problem was there wasn't anybody responsible. Mm-hmm. So that rage had to come out in different ways. And it came out in grieving. It came out in a huge sense of loss I can't put a time limit on it, but, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. It is gradual. But that 4 years is probably a good, as good an estimate as any for feeling that you have recovered as much as is humanly possible, mm-hmm. because you don't recover in the sense that you leave it behind you. You just find somewhere to put it. And it's important to put that grief where it has perspective so that it doesn't take over the rest of your life.
And 22 years later, we're discussing it here. It's still quite present in your life, mm-hmm. but you're managing to deal with it somehow.
Well, I think about him every day. He's still a part of my life and always will be. But he's now a part that is in perspective. And I remember I went to an ISANS. It's the at that time it was called the Irish Stillbirth and Neonatal Death Society. I think now it's called A Little Lifetime, whatever it's called. It's a wonderful organisation. And 7 weeks after Owen died, they had their annual conference, and they had invited a man called John O'Donoghue, who was a thanatologist, an expert in death. And listening to his words were the first spark of any kind of calm that I felt, any kind of relief that this was possible to recover from. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at the front row, the two front rows actually, at that conference, where there were people in their 70s and 80s who were there because they had never been allowed the opportunity to express their grief. In those days, it was dealt with by silence. Mm-hmm. You came home without a baby, the baby wasn't mentioned. And I thought, I do not want that in 30 or 40 years' time, that my life had to be put on hold mm-hmm. because I couldn't find a way to carry this with me rather than be carried by it.
Is it better then that you're able to talk about it and to share the experience?
I don't know how anybody survives without that. I mean, I have to, you know, hold up my hands in gratitude to family and friends who listened to me repeat the same story over and over and over again. And one of the things I learned, because I actually read and studied it at the time, because I wanted to know what was going on inside me, why I was having these particular emotions. And this notion, this is going over and over the same thing over and over again until you find a place for it to rest, apparently is a throwback to our ancestors, where they would walk around the safe circle of the fire over and over and over again. And this walking in circles, which I did physically as well for quite some time, that is our effort to actually process something. And that by dint of repetition, that you process something, you distill it into a place where it can become words, it can become music, it can become a prayer for those who believe. But it's a way of becoming familiar with something so that it no longer holds the terror that it used to.
How did it change you as a person then, Catherine, do you think?
I think it fundamentally changed the way I was living, not in any outer sense, but in a very personal, spiritual, inward way, which was, I suddenly felt, you've been given a second chance. Not many people get that. It was as though I had suddenly woken up from not asleep, because I don't believe I was asleep. I mean, I was alive and working and engaged with all of the things that I was doing, but it woke me to another level. And it made me feel that I have a gift for writing. Even if the gift isn't as large as I might like it to be, I have an impulse to write. And I now have the opportunity to do things with my life that I haven't before. I think the other thing was the understanding of just living now, not projecting forward always into the future, living on high alert, waiting for the next shoe to fall, but actually living now. And I think it made me engage even more and enjoy even more simple things like being with friends or being with my family or going out somewhere, taking the time to see a lovely sunset or to sit and listen to a piece of music. It made life seem much more urgent because at the same time, it made me feel a lot more vulnerable. So I suppose what I live with now is what I can describe as a consciousness of happiness.
Do you think you'd have pursued your writing to be published if this hadn't happened?
That's a very difficult question for me to answer. I think possibly eventually when I had more time on my hands, yes, that may have happened. But there was an urgency to this. It was one part of the writing, not immediately after Owen died, certainly, because I couldn't even put pen to paper, because the only thing that consumed me was loss. But I think in a funny way, my books became my babies.
Why have you picked Elgar's cello concerto for us to listen to, Catherine?
Because one of the things which I learned about grief, even at the time, was that it is not an unending dark tunnel. There are moments of calm. I used to call them my islands. It felt that I was navigating very stormy seas for most of the day. And then suddenly there would be a moment of calm. And often that calm was to get me ready for the next onslaught. But in the meantime, I could enjoy the calm. And I heard this piece of music being played on the radio one day, and I was transfixed by it. And my father happened to be in the house at that time. And I said to him, that must be one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard. And he said, that was your mother's favourite.
Oh.
And she had died 2 years earlier. So for all sorts of reasons, this became something I listened to over and over again.
That was Elgar's cello concerto, chosen by my guest this morning, Catherine Dunn. Catherine, our next piece of music is by Frank Sinatra. What's the story behind this piece?
There was always books and there was always music in our house. My father, in particular, was a great classical music aficionado. But they both, but I think particularly my mother, liked Frank Sinatra. And I can't remember the name of the album, but I can remember, I can still see it because it had a purple background and Frank Sinatra's smiling young face on it with a trilby at a very rakish angle. And my father and my uncle had built what was grandly called a gramophone. And when I look at it now and I see the size of an MP3 player, you know, it's very interesting to see how all of these things have changed. But the gramophone was constantly in use, and I remember my mother doing the housework, listening to Frank Sinatra. So that's a very strong memory. We're probably talking about, you know, the very early 1960s. At the most, I would have been 10. My brother told me my grandmother, my father's mother, apparently was very snobbish. And her home, my father's primary home, if you like, was where he had got his love of classical music. And when she came to visit, he used to hide the Frank Sinatra.
Well, we'll have a listen to it now. This is Don't Worry About Me.
Don't worry about me. I'll get along. Forget about me, be happy, my love.
And that was Frank Sinatra with Don't Worry About Me. Catherine, you were talking about your dad and the fact that he made the gramophone with your uncle. Mm. Where was that house? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Clontarf Park, just off Vernon Avenue. And it was a park of, I think, about 80 or 90 houses around a central green space. So it was a nice, open, light-filled place to grow up.
And there was obviously, you know, a culture of reading and writing in the house, because you said you used to read a lot when you were younger. Mm. Were your mother and father readers?
My mother in particular was a great reader. She left school when she was 14. When she was growing up, primary school used to extend to the age of 14 for people who couldn't afford to go on to secondary school. And I think that's one of the things that she really regretted, that she didn't have what she would call a proper education. But, you know, she spent a lot of time making up for that. She read widely. I always remember her going to the library and having books in the house. And the books, in fairness, were mostly from the library. The only ones I can remember that they owned were 12 leather-bound volumes of Butler's Lives of the Saints, which certainly didn't appeal to my father to read. I don't think anybody opened them. I was really strange. It was apparently, these were one of the gifts that it was deemed appropriate to give a couple getting married in the 1940s. So the books that were in the house would mostly come from the library, and also I think a book club my mother used to belong to, where she got things like the Kon-Tiki expedition and the Ra expedition. She was fascinated by all of those adventure stories, something I never got to talk to her about, actually, and would interest me now to find out why.
And your family then, they've kind of provided some inspiration for your books, because you have a book that's based on your grandmother, loosely based on your grandmother, let's say.
Yeah.
How did the rest of your family feel about you writing about her?
Well, my dad was from a family of eight in Belfast, and my grandmother had been, just to use a loose term, an arranged marriage. She was from Dublin, but she married my grandfather, who was an architect stroke builder in Belfast. All of the rest of the family, all of the aunts and uncles, left Belfast gradually and came to Dublin. And I remember seeing a photograph of my grandmother's wedding, very stiff sepia photograph, where she had this hat on, which needed its own landing strip. It was so huge, and it was full of net and tulle and birds and fruit and all this sort of stuff. And I remember seeing it as a child in my aunt's house and was fascinated by this. And then gradually, you know, I'd ask, who was she and where did you come from, and all the questions that children ask. And I felt this pull around the late 90s, I think, just to find out a little bit more about that branch of the family. Because obviously, when we were growing up, the troubles were raging in Belfast. It was not a place that we visited very often. So I was keen to find out something about my dad's background. And he was very keen to talk. And that was, it was very nice for me to be able to share a lot of those long term memories with my dad, who did suffer eventually from Alzheimer's. But these memories at that time were very strong. And he was delighted to talk about photographs and his youth. And my brother and I brought him to Hollywood to see the house where he was brought up. So all of this kind of fed into the writing of the book. Nobody had any difficulty with it, because It's fiction, obviously, because I'm only aware of a few facts of my grandmother's life. Mm-hmm. But the extraordinary thing is that nobody else in the family remembers that photograph, the photograph that sparked it. And now I'm not even sure whether it's real. And this is one of the fascinating things about memory. What my father remembers and what his sister or sisters remembered about similar events were often very different. Mm-hmm. So I just steered a course somewhere in the middle of that, and just because I was keen to find out what it was like on any level to be living in a society like that, that was so divided and where violence was always just below the surface.
Where else do you find your inspiration then, Catherine? Would you call yourself a nosy person?
Oh yeah, I think all writers are incurably nosy. I'm just curious about everybody, and curious about their stories, and curious about the way they look at the world.
And can I say that you write from a teenage perspective incredibly well? Did your time as a teacher kind of impact on your view of teenagers and be able to get that perspective of them?
I think it's a mix of a whole lot of different things. I think it's a mix of my own very vivid memories of how miserable it was to be a teenager, certainly for some of the time, as a parent, and also certainly as a teacher. And I think because my own teenage years were excruciating in so many ways, I can still identify with that. I can still find that voice somewhere inside the 60-year-old that, you know, can give expression to what it was like to be going through those challenging years.
But that's another thing about your writing, because, you know, it's been described as you have an orchestra of voices. You know, in a lot of the novels, you're writing from different voices. Mm-hmm. How do you manage to capture someone who's in their 60s, someone who's a teenager, a male perspective, a female perspective, or do you enjoy that challenge maybe?
Oh, I love it. It's great. It's a fantastic challenge. And I think all writing is an act of imaginative empathy. So in order to be able to write from anybody's point of view, you need to be able, in the words of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, you need to be able to step inside their shoes and walk around in them for a while. In the latest book, The Things We Know Now, I had serious trouble for the first 6 months trying to get the voice of the main character, of the narrator. And I automatically began with Ella, the mother, because I felt, well, that's the perspective I know best. Mm-hmm. But what happened was the mother just wasn't working for me, and she wasn't working because she was too familiar. And I just literally woke one morning with Patrick's voice inside my head, the father. Even the opening sentence telling the story from his point of view. And once I got that, I was away. So it's a mix of a whole lot of different things. Empathy would be the primary one. And then obviously you have to, you got to research, you got to try and find out how a man might respond to something rather than a woman. A lot of research, both emotional and practical.
And what are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on a new book, which doesn't have a title yet, but I've been very drawn recently towards Greek myth. So I'm looking at bringing a Greek myth up to date, because they had such a lot to teach us. I listened recently to the RTE production, the Burial at Thebes by Seamus Heaney, which was broadcast on Arena sometime after he died. I was just transfixed by it. I mean, it changed the language, changed the mechanics of the plot, and it speaks to us today. So the myth that I've chosen is Clytemnestra and Agamemnon. Agamemnon was not a nice man. And he kills Callista's first husband and drags her off to be his wife. And then he's responsible later on for the death of their daughter in order to give him fair winds to engage in the Battle of Troy. So I thought all of the bones were there for a really good story. So I have changed Agamemnon to Alexander and Clytemnestra to Callista.
We're going to end with the James Taylor song. Okay. Why did you pick it?
I picked this one because rather than all of the other records which I'd had up to this time, which had been borrowed from people, this one was mine. It was the first one I got as a gift, and my my eldest brother, John, gave it to me for my birthday. So I treasured it and I still have it.
Well, we'll end then with Mudslide Slim from James Taylor. The paperback edition of The Things We Know Now will be out in the shops this week. Congratulations again, Catherine, on the Giovanni Boccaccio International Prize for Fiction. And thank you so much for coming in to be my guest this morning.
And thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
I'll be back with you again the next same time next week. So good evening, so long.
Mudslide Slim and the Blue Horizon. Whoa, Mudslide, I'm depending on you.
Evening and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radioplayer.